The following presentation was recorded in 1998 at the Faith Builders Workshops on Child Development. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
All right, well, we're going to shift gears here and be a little more academic here for a while. And talk about important people in child development. I want to begin with some terms. There's a couple different kinds of theories that we're going to be looking at here in child development. And the different approaches people have taken. I just want to remind you again that child development is largely a subject that's been developed through observation. Okay, people have observed children and said, okay, what's going on here? How can we explain it? Of course, you have to understand, too, that what you basically believe to be true about life and reality is going to affect how you interpret what you see. And so if you believe that only what you can see is real, we call that empiricism. Sometimes you read about empirical evidence. Empirical evidence is evidence that can be discerned through one of the five senses. You can observe it. In some fashion, you can observe it. Well, if you believe that, then you're not going to take into account any kind of spiritual dynamic going on. You're not going to take into account the fact that there might be, well, you might, but generally you won't take into account the fact there might be certain things that are unique to this person because of the fact that he was created by God. Well, there's theories that focus on growth, and this basically refers to a sequence of changes or stages that takes place over time on the way to becoming an adult and is controlled for the most part by an inherited timetable. Okay, so we can watch birds. First there's an egg, then there's a little bird in the nest. And we can see it develop, and we can predict, if we watch and observe enough of them, we can predict what's going to happen when. You know, these things are all, if you teach science, you know all about that. Timetables are laid out. We know what's going to happen because we've observed it enough times to know. Well, this focuses on growth, and it's a sequence of changes or stages. An example might be, a child's head reaches full growth before his body. Okay? Well, that's something we know. And it's looking at one small segment of growth. Well, then there are theories that focus on learning. They try to understand child development based on what the child learns. And this refers to behavioral changes that come about due to influences from the environment. An example might be a child in the U.S. will learn to speak English. A child born in Germany will learn to speak German. You've heard of the family that was going to adopt a child from Central America, so they wanted to learn Spanish. They were going to adopt a baby, a newborn baby. They wanted to learn Spanish so this they could, you know, communicate with this Central American child. Well, they didn't understand something about environment, did they? Theories that focus on learning. Well, then there are developmental theories. And these usually explain changes in the child due to interaction between growth and learning. Now, you can begin to see here, if you focus only on growth, you're not going to take into account adequately what people learn, how they learn. And so, as some of these first theories came along and were based on growth, someone else comes along and says, wait a minute, that doesn't explain this over here. I think learning has something to do with this. And so they begin to try to explain, understand what's going on from the perspective of learning. and environment. Well, then someone else came along and said, well, neither one adequately fits, so I'm going to put the two together. And we're going to call it a developmental theory. And we're going to look at the interaction between growth, inherited tendencies, and learning, environmental influences. And there's the old debate that you might read about at times in the news. Maybe you can get this term down. It's called the nature-nurture debate. Nature versus nurture. Nature versus nurture. Okay, so what happens by nature? What's just inherited in the child? And what happens as a result of being nurtured? You know that if you never taught your child to read, it's highly unlikely that he'd ever learn to read. Something has to happen in his environment. We send him to school, or we sit down with him at home, and we begin to teach them. We create an environment where learning takes place. An example of developmental theory would be the observation that infants explore objects by five senses before they learn that those objects still exist when they're out of sight. You know, think about it. Infants explore by their mouth, by touching, by feeling, holding, smelling. They explore those objects before they learn, you know, then the parent comes, picks up the child, and leaves the toy in the crib. As far as that baby's concerned, that object probably doesn't exist. But comes a point in time when they realize, hey, I want that, and they go back and find that toy. Okay? Well, that's part of developmental theory. Certain learning is taking place through development. Well, then there are behaviorist theories. Behaviorist theories emphasize change that originates in the environment through learning. Okay, so here again we're talking about learning. How many of you have heard of Pavlov's dog? Have you heard that? Okay, a number of you have. Pavlov was a psychologist who decided he was going to, he believed that you could train and teach by introducing a certain stimulus, and that a certain stimulus would elicit a certain response. Okay. So, he said that a stimulus will bring about a response. So he had this dog in the cage, and he would, every time he put meat in the cage, he would ring a bell every time. And the dog would eat the meat. Of course, you know, dogs love good red meat, so this dog would snap it up and this bell would go. Every time this bell would go, he would ring the bell and put the meat in the cage. Ring the bell, put the meat in the cage. Ring the bell, put the meat in the cage. And after a while, he decided to see what would happen if he'd ring the bell and not put any meat in the cage. Well, what do you suppose happened in the dog? Those of you that don't know what happened. What do you suppose happened? What do you suppose the dog did? He started salivating. Okay, he started, there's no meat there. No food in sight. The bell was ringing. Now, what does a bell have to do with salivating? Not a thing. Except that the dog knew what always happened when the bell went. He had learned that when that bell goes, I'm getting red meat. So he began to salivate. Well, so they began to apply this then to learning. And you know, we talked about candy last night for motivation. We learned that, that was around before these behaviorists were around. But that's what they're talking about. A stimulus. Look, if you learn these facts and you can say them all in 3 minutes, I'll give you a piece of candy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, if they know they get a reward every time they do something, after a while a stimulus will get a response. And what we hope to do then as teachers, we hope that after a while the satisfaction of having accomplished something, like learning the facts in so many minutes, we can recall them, we hope that we can transfer that motivation from the piece of candy to internal motivation, satisfaction by having done a job well. So that's what we talk about, stimulus response behavior. And by the way, if you use individualized curriculum or Saxon math or any of those things, we call it programmed instruction. Programmed instruction. You read a little bit, you write an answer. I got it right. Oh, okay, good. So I read a little more and I write in the answer. That's programmed instruction. It grows out of behaviorism theory that says if you create the right conditions, people can learn. If you reward behavior, learning will follow. Now, let's look a little bit at some terms. In fact, I should leave this on here maybe. We look at four different things. Talk about child development. We look at cognitive development. Well, I can recall these. I have a better check here. Cognitive, we look at physical. They're coming back to me now. Affective. Those are three main areas of development that we look at when we look at child development. This has to do with mind and thinking. This, of course, has to do with what we also call this motor skills at times. And this has to do with emotional and social. Those are the main areas we look at in child development. And then some have come along and said that there's an extra category. These are, of course, not Christian people. But some have said there's also moral development. A man by the name of Kohlberg talked about that. Moral development, because he didn't feel any of these other three adequately explained how people develop the ability to choose between right and wrong. I'm not sure if you can read this. I tried to enlarge it. We just want to do an overview of the number of people and theories, things they believe. Can you see it in the back? Raise your hand if you can see it, if you can read it. A little bit, a little rough, hey? Yes. Can you hit the switch closest, the bank of three, the switch closest to you there? There we go. Is that any better? Okay. Let's talk about a few of these people. This chart is an attempt to put together and compare. But I want to begin with the earliest one. We see Freud right here. Sigmund Freud. You've heard about, we've heard about Freudian psychology. These are some of the significant people in the realm of child development. You have to understand that I am not telling you that these are all legitimate explanations for what happens. But again, I wanted you to be familiar with some of these people, and I think it helps us understand when we read articles in the newspaper, talk with people, that hopefully we can begin to recognize some of these things. Freud, again, dealt with a growth and development approach to theory. He was one of these development and growth people. And one of the things I'd understand about Freud is that he did very little what's thought of as truly scientific explanation or approach to his theories about people. He would have clients in his office. He was a medical doctor, by the way. And he was trying to understand and explain why these people behave and think the way they do. So he began to develop some ideas. And if you'll see in these categories, he has a very physical, sexual approach to explaining people's behavior. And some of these... there is limited truth to what he says, but it's been amazing that because his assumptions rest on some evolutionary and naturalistic thinking, people that have just lapped up what he has had to say. He wrote extensively and had several men who were avid disciples of what he thought and who expanded on his theories. But he developed this into four stages. He talked about the oral stage, where he said the mouth is the source of pleasure. Feeding and teething are central. Well, it is true that babies, everything's got to go to the mouth. You know, we have to be careful that we don't put too much in front of them or they will swallow it, choke on it, who knows why. But he observed this and says, well, from birth to about 18 months, it's an oral stage. The mouth is the source. He's thinking in terms of pleasure now. You have to understand that. He's thinking in terms of pleasure. What he thinks people live and react out of what brings pleasure. Okay, and so the mouth is the source of feeding and teething. Well, then he moves to the anal stage. How he figured this one out, I'll never know. But from 18 months to about 6 years, or to 3 years, he talks about bowel movements and how they're a source of pleasure, and toilet training is a critical area. That's why you hear the old jokes about how I was messed up because my parents didn't potty train me right. That's a joke out of Freudian psychology. Okay? And it's generally, there's many, many psychologists that today basically say Freud was out to lunch. Okay? He didn't have a clue. But there are also people today who built their whole counseling philosophy based on Freud. And you can see why some of us are maybe kind of messed up. Well, then he moved into the phallic stage, and he talked about sexual identification and conscience development are critical in this stage. And he has some strange ideas about attraction of sons to their mothers and daughters to their fathers. He had serious problems himself morally. Then he talks about the latency stage. Child consolidates previous stages development. So he says, in the 7 to 13, and it is. If you'll observe, from age of 7 to 13, development and change seems to slow down a little. Oh, there's growth in awareness and academic ability and reading ability, and they continue to add to knowledge. But from 0 to 5, we see tremendous, just explosive development. In 1 year's time, a child can be saying words, can be walking, goes from complete helplessness to an amazing amount of independence. We don't see that kind of explosive change taking place for between 7 and 13. Okay, so he explained that simply. He said latency. He said, well, this just continues to grow and expand, develop, which kind of brings everything together. Again, he makes broad statements because he didn't do a lot of observation. Well, a man by the name of Carl Jung, a German, I think it would be Jung, you may see his name around, was a disciple of Freud. And his psychology was absorbed by a lot of Christian people back around in the 30s to the 50s. But again, beware of Carl Jung. The man had serious moral problems. And while it sounds good on the surface, much of what he has to, most if not all of what he has to say is suspect. One that I do find that says a lot that seems to connect with what we observe and believe to be true is Erik Erikson. Again, he also dealt with emotions, social areas, personality, a developmental and a growth approach to child development theory. But again, he looked at the social environment and the personality, and he, again, categorizes according to crisis. He said there were four crises that come about in a child's life. And he labeled the first one trust versus mistrust. The relationship with the caretaker during feeding is central. Now, I think a lot of us believe that. I think when a child is born, most of us in our churches, in our circles, would encourage the mother to nurse. And the medical community has done a complete reverse on that and had a big push saying that it's important to how the baby connects and bonds with the mother. So, trust versus mistrust. The relationship between the caretaker during feeding is central. Okay, so we could say, well, there's some truth to that. Is it a complete and adequate explanation? Probably not. Crisis two, as he said, was autonomy versus shame and doubt. Okay, so how much independence is this child going to get as he grows between 18 months and 3 years? And here he says the child strives for independence. And someone has said, too, that the child, when a child takes his first step, he's already declaring his independence from the parent. Very dependent yet, not at all ready to face the big wide world, but is at some level already saying, look, Mom, I don't need you quite as much as I did. And we, if we're healthy parents, delight in that. We love to see a child learn to walk. Everybody just gets so excited when that first step is taken. Because it's growth, it's normal development, and we're excited about it. But if that child is shamed and is not allowed independence, it's a crisis point. And his whole theory is based on the fact that at some points in life, things are more important than at other points in life. That's what he bases it on. Well, crisis three, initiative versus guilt. Ages 3 to 6, the child plans and carries out activities and learns society's boundaries. And that is true. I think by the age of 5, a child needs to understand and respect no. If you haven't taught it by the time he's 5 or 6 years old, you're in trouble. If they are not able to respond to no, because it's an acknowledgement that there's an authority in their life. And if they're not able to respond to that authority, it's going to be increasingly difficult. The older they get beyond that point, it's going to become increasingly difficult to teach them that respect. And then crisis four, industry versus inferiority. He needs to be productive and successful. Failure results in feeling inferior. And there's some truth to that again, because as a teen, we want to be able to do something worthwhile. We want to feel like we can do something as we reach the teen years. Well, another significant person in child development who worked primarily in the cognitive domain was a man by the name of Piaget. That's how you pronounce his name. It's Piaget. He tried to look at thinking and say, how does the thinking process develop? I see some of you are fighting sleep. Isn't this great stuff? Okay, cognitive. The sensory motor period. The child's sensory, his hearing, tasting, touching, seeing, smelling, and motor skills develop and are the means for learning. So he's looking at how the child learns. So how does his mind develop? And he calls it the sensory motor period. So the senses are active. Hearing, seeing, smelling, touching. Okay, then we had the motor. And children, aren't they just busybodies? Friends of ours have a little baby that's not so much a baby anymore. Just starting, they said, their first child, just starting to crawl over to something, you know, pull things off the end tables and, you know, pull things off of couch or furniture. Okay, well, motor skill development. That's what's happening. This child's becoming aware that there are things around. I want to see what that is. Crash. Okay? That's how they're learning. Sensory motor. The second stage he looked at was the pre-operational period. And what he meant by that was that language and cognitive development are rapid as learning takes place through imitation, play, and other self-initiated activities. Now, it's interesting. When I was taking a class on this, we had to do some activities with children. And one of the things I had to do was show a child two different containers. And one was a tall, narrow container. I would fill that with water. And then I would take another small container that was wide, but not as tall. Okay? So one is tall, one is short, and then the tall one is narrow, the short one is wide. Okay, well, I'd fill the tall one to the top. And I would say, is that full? The child looks at it and he says, yeah, it's full. I said, do you think Do you think this over here, this jar here will hold all that water? They look at it, study it for a while. This is a first grader, 6, 7 years old. He'd look at it and he'd say, I don't think so. I don't think it can hold that. I said, well, let's see what happens. We pour it. Let's see how much it holds. I pour it in, it only fills it up halfway. Well, they look at that and I say, well, what happened? How's it come? Well, they don't have a clue. They cannot process that simple, and it's pre-operational. They cannot abstract. They think concretely. Okay? So I asked them, what do you think? How full do you think it'll make this tall one? Well, they know it was just full, but they sit there and they just scratch, well, I don't know it. And you pour it back in, and they can't believe that it filled it all the way up. And you can't even get them to say, you think it'll fill it up? They'll finally say, I don't think it'll fill it up. And you fill it up, and boom, right up to the top. And they don't know what to say. They feel a little, foolish. Well, pre-operational. They cannot abstract. But as they get into 7 to 13 years of age, they can move into concrete operations. Abstract symbols and ideas can be applied to concrete experiences. Okay, that's why we don't teach algebra before about 8th grade. Because children just cannot abstract to that point. So he made some valid observations. And again, what I want you to see in this chart is that there's a lot of truth in this chart. People were just observing, but their theory determined what conclusions they would draw from the observations they made. And so I think as Christians, we can learn a lot from these people about children. But we need to be careful that it corresponds to what we know to be true from Scripture. Well, someone else is a man by the name of Lev Vygotsky. Vygotsky. Vygotsky contributed to our view of how children learn to think and speak. And he looked at primarily social issues. What he said, if we can have a caring adult in the room with this child and someone who cares about this child and provides learning experiences, this child will learn. So he looked at social things. And it is true. Will children learn much if there's not a caring adult in their life? No, they won't. And so that's a necessary ingredient. We can say, well, I could have told him that. I don't need a degree in child development to tell him that. Well, what he's simply doing is trying to put together an adequate description. Okay, so how do they learn? What is required for a child to learn? And so he said, well, it requires some social interaction. And he just noted the importance of this adult and peer interaction to the young child's learning. And he worked on understanding of cognitive development. Now, this gives us a clue into how we teach. Don't we say that if a child is to learn as much as possible, that love makes a big difference in this child's life? Well, what are you doing? You're being a caring, loving adult in the child's life. And so he again divides these into categories. Doesn't have a lot to say here on this chart. Two more people. A man by the name of Sears. He did not start Sears and Roebuck Company, but his name was Sears. He came from a needs and motivation standpoint. Remember what I talked about, needs-based theories in child development and psychology. People that say, well, I think if people just have their needs met, they will become healthy. If we can just have our needs met. That is not an adequate view. Christianly, that's not an adequate view because we make choices which are not just based on needs. But he looked at needs and motivation and made some observations, and he said he called phase one learning, early learning, and he based it on innate needs. We need food, we need comfort, we need personal contact. Okay, those are the needs. Well, phase two then, he talked about secondary behavioral systems based on family-centered learning. Well, basically what he's saying there is that when you grow up in a family, you learn how to act, how to behave to men, how to relate to women, how to relate to people, how to be responsible. And you develop character. And then he talked about, And notice, he's coming from a needs motivation basis. So what does this have to do? Learning how to relate to people. He says that in order to live with these people, you have to learn how to do that. If you don't learn how to relate, then you can't live with them. Life has problems, so you're motivated to learn how to live with these people. Then phase three, secondary motivational systems based on extra familial learning. In other words, outside of family. What else comes into play? And he talks about independence balancing dependence. We talk about healthy relationships requiring a certain level of dependence on the other person. It requires a certain level of independence. If you have a friend and you just insist that you have to have this friend with you all the time, you're going to have a certain level of dependence that's not going to feel very good to that friend. It's not a natural, it's not a healthy, I should say, friendship. So there needs to be some independence and some dependence. But you still, on a certain level, need that friend in order to feel good and enjoy life. Now, let me just toss this in here. People talk about, we hear people today talk about, you know, I need, you know, so much, this much time away from my children. I need to have an outlet, and so I need to work, you know, 10 hours a week, or I need to have three friends. I need these people. Well, immediately my mind comes, okay, you need these people. Well, how badly do you need these people? Isn't it true that if you're put in a concentration camp, solitary confinement, there's no way those needs are going to be met? Are you still going to survive? Okay. And of course, we have tremendous stories coming out all the time about how people survived incredible conditions where we consider basic needs, those were not being met in those situations. But we love to hear those stories and hear how they learned to survive without those things. So I want to be careful to qualify when we talk about needs-based theories. Let's talk about one more person. Gazelle. The Gazelle people, they talked about physical and motor development. And one of the things they talked about is that certain things have to be in place physically before a child can learn to read. For instance, why is it that most first graders lose their front teeth about the time they're in first grade? They learn to read. Well, the Gazelle people said, well, that's indication that you're probably, that's one indication that you ought to look at if you consider school and reading readiness. Have they lost their front teeth? Isn't that amazing? But look at it. It's true. And they've noticed that children that do not lose their front teeth until 8, 9, 10 years old, they'll struggle in this whole thing in reading. Okay, so somewhere there's a correspondence physically, and they've developed a whole basis here from which to think about learning based on physical development. And there have been some amazing conclusions drawn as they've done their homework here in observing what happens, what needs to be in place. So from birth to 18 months, the body develops rapidly from head to toe. This person lifts the head, then the shoulders, then sits up, and from the center out, reaches, then grasps. Look at how they've developed that. They've looked at what happens first. They lift the head, then the shoulders, then they sit up. Okay, then it's from the center out. He reaches, then he grasps. And they've tried to determine in great detail how this all happens. And then they say by age 6, the rate of development levels off. At ages 7 to 13, the child can engage in activities requiring more physical strength and coordination. All right, can we have the lights again back there? Okay, well, we've looked at some of these people now. In the areas in which they have worked to develop and we've said that child development is basically a system of thought or developed out of observation. We don't read a lot about it in Scripture. It's basically people have made observations. Well, what kinds of observations do we have? Or what kind of, maybe I shouldn't say observations, what kind of methods do we use to study children? Already talked about the one. And we call, and really this is really the scientific method. See Dwayne Tucker sitting back there. You correct me if I'm wrong on this. Scientific method. It's basically one of observation. You observe, you make some predictions about what you think is going to happen, and you test it. And you see if it happens repeatedly. It's a scientific method. We can observe. And we just look at what happens, what we can see. Well, there's another method. We look at relationships. Now, this is closely related to this one because it's still observing and trying to determine it. But then we look at what happens and we view it through the lens of relationship. And it's interesting. A gentleman by the name of Bronfenbrenner has looked at this and categorized a number of areas that we can look at in relationship. He says, first of all, you can look at the child's home, his family, his immediate surroundings. When you look, and he's called this the microsystem. Okay? He said, if you can look at the child, and look at their relationship to home, school, neighborhood, peer group, church, all these areas. Because his stress has been that you need to look at the child in the complete context. Well, we, at least if you're like me, we tend to think of that, well, that's about it, isn't it? Home, family, church, school. Well, he says, no, there's three other areas that are just as important. He talks about the mesosystem. The mesosystem. That includes all the interactions and relationships between the home, the church, the school. So here, we have the child, and we have the home, we have the church, we have the school, and whatever else. We call that the microsystem. Well, then it says the mesosystem is how these relate to each other. Okay, so now he's going to look at the interactions that we have there. And he calls it the mesosystem. Well, he adds another one, exosystem. There you can see the exo, external, outside. He adds the exosystem. And in that category, he puts things like school boards, libraries, media. Okay, isn't it true that the community at large, some of the structures that are in place around all these other interactions, they do influence what's available. How many newspapers are in your town? How much news do you get? How much opportunity do you get to go to the library? And what are the policies of the library that allow you to enjoy? How big a library is it? How much business opportunity is there in your town? And if you grow up in Guy's Mills and never travel out of Guy's Mills, I always call it Hicktown, USA. Just a little grocery store and a post office and a fire department. Well, I'm from northern Indiana, which is just about the larger metropolis of Chicago, you know. And there's just all kinds of opportunity in northern Indiana. It's a different environment than growing up in Guy's Mills. It's amazing. It's if you come from Lancaster, you know what I mean. You're busy out there, too. Okay, well, he adds one more, which he calls the macro system. The macro system. And That is what he calls the dominant values and ideologies of the culture. That's the culture at large. Okay, is that an impact on the child's life? The dominant values of the culture at large. Sure it is. That's going to impact that child. So when you look at this child, it becomes much more complex. And he's done some good work here in thinking through this. The microsystem, family, church, school. Well, then he's looked at the mesosystem. How do these three relate? If the people in the home think the people at school are out to lunch, it's going to be a problem. It's going to impact that child. If the church doesn't support the school, doesn't think the school is very important, it's going to affect the child, his attitudes about school, about church. That's the mesosystem. The exosystem is the things in the surrounding community, whether it's industry, whether it's legal issues, all those things are going to, and then the macro system, the dominant beliefs, values, ideologies of the culture. Well, that's observation relationship. We need to add one more that many in our world today will not add, and we call it revelation. Revelation. By revelation, we mean that God has spoken into our situation. God has spoken into our situation, and we are not left without any kind of outside knowledge. Now you think about it. Stuff really sticks. This is planet Earth. This is the created order, right? If this is all there is, we don't have anything coming in from outside of what this of our world right here. And that's how modern man looks at our situation. He's constantly looking out into the universe, trying to explain it, describe it, find, you know, we're looking for life. I think over the weekend someone mentioned that I think it was Melvin that mentioned that, and he read in the article, that they're actually wanting to see if they can't pierce the surface of Mars and release the water that's supposedly trapped inside Mars. And they want to land on Mars and do this and get this water on the surface of Mars so that they can create another blue planet. See, we're the only blue planet this time, isn't that right? So, if you didn't believe there's any outside knowledge coming in, it's like Melvin said, I'd be all for that program if I didn't believe there's any outside knowledge, or else you'd commit suicide. There's no point. Or else you'd get all the pleasure you can while you're on this little place, and then when you die, it's over. But God has spoken into this situation. We call that revelation. How has he done it? Well, he's done it through Scripture. And of course, in the Old Testament, he did it through the prophets. He spoke. And he did, as Psalm 78 says, he did mighty acts. He overruled the created order and did unnatural things, spoke into it. So he did mighty acts. The greatest speaking into, if I may say it that way, that he did was in the person of Jesus Christ. He revealed himself. Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So that's revelation. We call all of that revelation. So those are methods, ways of knowing, observation, relationship, which is closely, we could almost categorize that with observation, and then revelation, ways of knowing. Okay, now as you teach, we're talking child development, what kind of observations are you going to be making in the children? Now, we've talked about needs of children. We've talked about how people have observed. How are you going to go about? We talk in teaching, we talk about the teacher being a theorist. In other words, you're going to be watching, observing your students, and you're going to be saying, okay, I think based on what I know about the subject, based on what I know about people, based on what I know about how people learn, I'm going to say that I think this is what happens. Here's my theory about how this happens. Here's what I believe. And it may be more than a theory, but here's what I believe to be true. Well, of course, the bell rings at 8:30 and something happens. People come in the door and you become the practitioner. All right? You put your theory to work. You don't have a whole lot of time to think about why you're doing what you're doing. You've planned it out. You've already thought about the why, and you're going to put it to work. And so you teach. And you operate out of what you believe. Well, come the end of the day, though, and the bell rings again at 3 o'clock or whenever it rings, and the children go home, and you sit down, maybe collapse in your chair, and you look at, okay, how did the day go? And you look at the pile of ungraded papers, and you look at the clock, and you know you have a lot to do, so you get at it, you grade it, you plan the next day's lesson. Well, as you grade the papers, you're doing some evaluating. You can kind of see, well, they didn't catch that. Everybody missed this, and they did well here. And you begin again. You have to think, okay, so why didn't they get that? And you again begin to rethink. So you're always thinking about how this happens. Well, what are some ways in child development? We look at some ways that we can add to what we know up in here. And then, of course, it works itself out in what we practice. One of these things is that we can what's called diary, or we could call it journal. Another thing we can do is parent interview. I'm not going to comment much on these because they're pretty obvious. This one takes a lot of work. You have to be a researcher at heart to really enjoy this one. You're just going to observe and say what happened every day, and you're going to begin to collect information. You're just collecting information. The second one is that you talk to parents. And I'm big on this one. You can learn a lot by parent interviews. You can learn a lot. Another thing you can do is you can interview the child. You can talk to the child. We call it interview. Maybe it should be better to call it discussing. Talking with the child. And you can learn a lot by talking, interacting with the child. These three things are the ways, methods that people use to learn about children. And of course, included in this one is one we could add underneath here, just observation, which we've talked a little bit about already. Observation. Methods that people use. Well, you might ask the question, when is all this supposed to happen? I mean, when I teach, I'm busy. And so I think the important thing is that we periodically take time to reflect. Of course, summers are good for this. Summers are good in that they give us time to chew on how the year went, what happened, and begin to draw some conclusions about children and how we go about teaching them. All right. Why don't we just, some of you are fighting sleep a little bit, why don't we just stand and take your, we haven't sung our song yet. Turn to 467. To spend just a little bit of time in our groups again, talking and discussing a couple questions as we wrap up what we've been thinking about. First question I'd like you to think about relates back to what we were talking about with the seven needs that children have. Of those seven needs, I'd like for you to think carefully, and I'd like for you to try to evaluate two. What two of those seven that we discussed do you think are most are missed the most in your school community? Okay, so I'm just asking you to make some tentative conclusions about that. In your observation, especially if you've taught for a year, or two, or three, or ten, what most often do you see out of those seven needs? What do you see that's missing? And I'd like to just have you see if there's any correlation in the group. Do most of you have, you know, are there two or three or four maybe that all of you would say, these are the most critical. I really resonate with this one. It makes sense to me in light of what I deal with in the classroom. These are the ones that are not being met. That's number one. What are two? And then compare notes a little and talk about what could be done. What can you do as a teacher to meet those needs in the child's life, and what perhaps could you do to begin to encourage it in parents? Second question then has to do with some of the theories that we talked about. I'd like for you to just tell the group which one made the most sense to you. Maybe you're going to say none. Well, which one seemed to make the most sense? And then take that then, and more than just making a value judgment there, discuss how you can put these theories. Does it heighten our awareness at all? How can you put these things into practice in your classroom? What kind of impact do these theories have on your classroom? See if you can discuss that. So those would be the two things. We can take about 20 minutes.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.